ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
As the U.S. tries again to broker a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, new attempts to provide humanitarian aid in Gaza are being described as chaotic. We will get the latest from our reporter in Tel Aviv. For Saturday, May 31st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told leaders from Asian nations at a summit in Singapore.
We do not seek to dominate or strangle China, to encircle or provoke.
And deciphering another whirlwind week for tariffs and global trade.
Businesses don't know what the tariff policy is going to be tomorrow, let alone 2-3 years from now, the way they have to be planning.
Plus, it's 25 years to the day since the first episode of Survivor aired. We will visit a group of superfans who creates their own version of the competition every year. Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The European Union says it's prepared to impose counter-tariff plans. Now, the President Trump doubled his tariffs on steel and aluminum imports to 50%. An EU spokesperson says they had paused their planned tariffs in hopes of reaching an agreement. Terry Schultz has more.
A spokesperson for the European Union's executive says the bloc strongly regrets Trump's decision to raise tariffs on steel imports from 25 to 50%. The decision adds further uncertainty to the global economy and increases costs for consumers and businesses on both sides of the Atlantic, the spokesperson said in a statement. They added that this move also undermines ongoing efforts to reach a negotiated solution, which was the reason the EU decided in April to hold off imposing its own tariffs. But now the spokesperson says the European Commission is finalizing its decisions on countermeasures and will put them into effect on July 14th or even earlier if, in their words, no mutually acceptable solution is reached. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The Trump administration is facing criticism from Jewish civil rights leaders over its pick to lead a government agency that enforces ethics laws. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has more.
President Trump announced that he is nominating Paul Ingrassia to lead the Office of Special Counsel. That's a government agency that protects government whistleblowers and makes sure government employees follow ethics rules. Ingrassia is 30 years old and graduated from law school in 2022. He also has ties to multiple anti-Semitic extremists. Ingrassia has repeatedly praised the self-described misogynist influencer Andrew Tate, who has promoted Holocaust revisionism. And the Anti-Defamation League told NPR that Ingrassia's nomination, quote, undermines ongoing efforts to combat anti-Semitism at this critical moment. The White House said it stands by Ingrassia, dismissing the criticism as a smear campaign. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Millions of Americans are under alert for compromised air quality this weekend because of out-of-control wildfires ravaging the forests of the Canadian province of Manitoba. NPR's Alana Weiss has more.
Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota have all issued air quality alerts for their residents. This comes as 17,000 Manitobans have been forced to flee their homes as dangerous fires cut through the province's prized wildlands. The evacuation effort is the largest in recent history for Manitoba. These fires come on the heels of two consecutive years of devastating wildfire seasons. In all three affected states, experts warn that the air quality is unsafe for people like children and the elderly. In Minnesota, which is projected to be the hardest hit, the air quality will be reduced to the point of danger for sensitive groups and some members of the general public. Alana Wise, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Hamas says it will release 10 living and 18 deceased hostages still held in Gaza. This in response to the U.S. proposal for a ceasefire. Earlier this week, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff proposed that deal, which includes a 60-day ceasefire. Israel accepted it, but it's not a done deal because Hamas is seeking other demands, according to Israeli and Arab media reports, including comprehensive withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza and a permanent end to the war. More than 54,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel since the war began nearly 20 months ago when Hamas militants attacked Israel, killing about 1,200. When people get a scratch or an infection, the body responds better if it happens during the day. NPR's Burley McCoy reports on how the immune system tells time.
Scientists have known that many cells in the immune system have built-in circadian clocks. genes that tell them to respond differently depending on the time. But scientists weren't quite sure how the immune system was telling time. To figure it out, researchers used baby zebrafish, which are transparent, with modified immune cells that give off fluorescent light. The team exposed the fish to fluorescent bacteria and watched how the immune cells responded when it was light or dark. During the day, the immune cells killed bacteria faster, but when researchers cut out certain circadian clock genes from the immune cells, they lost that ability. This knowledge could allow scientists to rally immune cells to respond to a bad infection. They published their findings in the journal Science Immunology. Burleigh McCoy, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Hamas has responded to a U.S. ceasefire proposal in Gaza that includes the release of around half of its remaining living hostages. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff proposed the deal this week, and Israel accepted. This latest development comes amidst a dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The United Nations has called Gaza the hungriest place on earth. Israel continues to restrict humanitarian aid into the enclave, and this week it introduced a new distribution system, one run by a U.S.-backed private company. For more on all of this, we go to NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with that proposal. What do we know about Hamas's response?
So we know that Hamas said they've agreed to release 10 living and 18 deceased hostages. That's in exchange to Israel releasing a number of Palestinian prisoners. We don't know how many yet. And this is all meant to happen during a 60-day ceasefire. You know, Hamas has really been under pressure to accept a deal by mediators, including Egypt, Qatar, and the United States, and by Palestinians in Gaza who are desperate for a ceasefire.
Perpetual question then, is it a done deal?
Nope, definitely not. A Hamas official who spoke on condition of anonymity because he wasn't authorized to speak publicly told us that the militant group has asked for a number of demands. That includes the timing of the release of the hostages. You see, Hamas wants a guarantee that Israel will hold to the 60 days of the ceasefire, so it doesn't want to release all the 10 hostages at the same time. Hamas also wants guarantees for a permanent end to the war, the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, and the entry of aid. And Israel is framing all of this as Hamas rejecting the proposal.
Let's get into the other big development I talked about. Tell us about this new system of food being delivered in Gaza and this U.S.-backed group that's running it.
Yeah, so we just need to really understand that Gaza has been under a total blockade of aid since March 2nd. No food, medicine, or any supplies at all have gone in since then. So after intense international pressure, Israel started allowing a trickle of aid by the UN and this new distribution system. This new system is not under the control of the United Nations, which Israel has long accused of anti-Israel bias. And actually, the UN has refused to participate in it anyway. Israel also says that Hamas steals the aid, but the UN says there's been no major diversion. So this group was just formed, and it's called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. It's run by American security contractors, and it's been unclear on who funds it. We've asked several times, but haven't received an answer. GHF began setting up a few aid distribution sites on Monday, and they're actually all in dangerous combat zones. And before, when the UN was in charge, there were hundreds of aid centers.
How did this rollout go?
Well, according to people on the ground that we spoke to, it's been chaos. We spoke to one man in Gaza who said that as soon as the GHF workers opened the metal fences where the aid was being distributed, hundreds of people stormed it in desperation and started grabbing as many meal boxes as they could. Another man we reached by phone, 55-year-old Iyad Jalous, said he walked more than 7 miles to and from the GHF site, but he says it was impossible to get anything. Swarms of people, he said, huge crowds, people jostling and stomping on each other, people gasping for breath. Jalous said that there were Israeli military tanks in the distance while the contractors looked on. And also the rollout hasn't really been safe. There have been shots fired and people around the sites have seen injured people being taken to the hospital. And Gaza health officials have reported deadly gunfire.
What has it been like in other areas of Gaza?
Well, Israel is continuing to order these huge evacuations orders, including new ones on Thursday for much of the north of Gaza. Of course, airstrikes continue, killing hundreds of Palestinians this week. And health officials say that children have died from malnutrition. The UN's Palestinian ambassador delivered a speech this week, and he broke down in tears as he described Palestinian children in Gaza.
Images of mothers embracing their motionless bodies, caressing their hair, talking to them. It's unbearable.
I mean, you can really hear the intense emotion in his voice.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier, though. Tell us more about why the United Nations and other experienced aid organizations are not cooperating with GHF.
Well, the UN says that this system is violating humanitarian principles and breaks international law. That's because it says the GHF system will, quote, weaponize aid for Israel's political purposes. The Israeli government has said it wants to move all Palestinians to the south of Gaza, and some Israeli officials have said they want to displace them totally out of Gaza. The UN says this aid system also would help do that because Israel controls who receives the aid and where it's set up, and that would end up possibly emptying out large parts of the territory. And the UN says this constitutes a criteria for ethnic cleansing.
That is NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
On a visit to Asia, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth signaled the U.S. will reorient its policy in the region toward, as he put it, quote, deterring aggression by communist China. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Singapore.
This was Secretary Hegseth's first appearance at the Shangri-La Dialogue, the region's main annual defense forum. He came with a stark warning about China.
China seeks to become a hegemonic power in Asia, no doubt. It hopes to dominate and control too many parts of this vibrant and vital region.
But at the same time, he said, the U.S. does not seek war.
We do not seek to dominate or strangle China, to encircle or provoke. We do not seek regime change.
Chinese Air Force retired Senior Colonel Zhou Bo has been to many of these forums. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He says Hegseth's speech was more hostile to China than previous U.S. defense secretaries who spoke at the forum, and he seems to be pushing other countries to pick a side in the U.S.-China rivalry.
China would not ask anyone to pick sides, and even if China does, nobody would pick Chinese side if they know that the other side is the United States.
And yet, Joe says, instead of rushing to take the U.S. side, many countries in the region are hedging their bets. Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim told the forum his country intends to remain staunchly non-aligned.
What Southeast Asia needs is a dynamic equilibrium that enables cooperation without coercion and a balance without bloc politics.
What worries some U.S. allies is that the U.S. may prioritize confronting China over protecting them. South Korea, for example, is concerned that the U.S. could draw down forces based on the Korean Peninsula or repurpose them to defend Taiwan in case of an attack by China. South Korea sees its main security threat coming from its nuclear-armed neighbor to the north.
I think the message from the Trump administration is that all that matters is what Korea does on China.
Zach Cooper is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank.
And the reality is that U.S.-Korea interests go far beyond what South Korea does on China.
The Pentagon denies it's planning to pull soldiers out of South Korea, but it continues to insist that it must have the strategic flexibility to put troops where it needs them. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Singapore.
Tomorrow kicks off Pride Month, and the political climate has many drag performers worried about safety. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports one group has released guidelines to help people stay safe this June and beyond.
Freddie Hercury is a drag king in Buffalo, New York. They channel the spirit of Queen's charismatic frontman, Freddie Mercury, on stage, as in this performance captured on Facebook. I want to break free. Pride is a busy time and not always easy. Last year, Hercury received a bomb threat on Facebook ahead of a gig in Niagara Falls.
I was like, okay, well, that doesn't make me feel great.
Hercury had just heard about a new network of drag performers and their allies whose aim it is to help people in just these situations. This group is called Committee, spelled with a Q, not a C. Hercury reached out to them.
They were immediately responsive and really just kind of walked me through the process of how I wanted to handle it.
Hercury reported the threat to the FBI. The gig went ahead with no incident. Committee has dispensed a lot of security advice to drag artists over the past year and has now, with help from lawyers and other experts, distilled it into the Drag Defense Handbook.
This handbook is a collaborative collection of experiences from drag artists across the country who have experienced hatred or threat and what they've done to stand up and make these safe spaces.
Drag performer Veranda Lanai is based in Cleveland and helped put together the handbook. It contains best practices for dealing with everything from online doxing to bomb attacks. Lanai herself has been a target. A man from a neo-Nazi group threw a Molotov cocktail into a church to prevent her from leading a drag queen story hour in 2023. No one was hurt. The culprit admitted he wanted to, quote, protect children. He was arrested and sentenced to 18 years in prison.
There are steps to be had, making sure that you screen capture everything, make sure everything is documented, making sure you have security around you, knowing your First Amendment protections.
According to the LGBTQ advocacy nonprofit GLAAD, there have been more than 80 attacks, both online and physical, specifically targeting drag performers in the US over the past year. The number is actually a big drop from the previous year, less than half. In a statement, the organization attributed the decline in part to the drag community getting smarter about safety and security. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
In a moment, you may have listened to NPR Live special coverage before, but have you ever wondered what it's like to host during a fast-breaking story?
I think there's something about live coverage that allows you to get caught up in the moment in a way that is journalistically appropriate, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about an inauguration or a new pope or the emotion of a tragedy if you're covering a war or a natural disaster.
A behind-the-scenes look at sitting in the NPR host chair during our special coverage as we're broadcasting at live events around the world, asking questions in order to bring you the facts. That's coming up. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The European Union says it regrets President Trump's decision to double tariffs on aluminum and steel imports to 50%. And a spokesperson says the EU is now finalizing decisions on countermeasures that will be put into effect in July if the EU and the US can't reach an agreement.
Hamas says it's agreeing to some of the terms of a U.S. proposal to end the violence in Gaza. Israel has agreed to the plan, which includes a temporary ceasefire. Hamas says it will release 10 living hostages and the bodies of 18 others in exchange for the release of a number of Palestinian prisoners. And in Texas, the state legislature approved a bill giving $8.5 billion to school, including raises for teachers and money for full-day pre-K care. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump told a crowd outside of Pittsburgh last night that he is doubling tariffs on imported steel, though it is unclear when that would happen. The announcement is just the latest plot point in Trump's ongoing global trade war. Newly released trade figures show that imports to the U.S. plunged nearly 20% last month. And that, of course, is when Trump's worldwide tariffs kicked in. Now the future of those tariffs is up in the air after a pair of court rulings this past week found the president had overstepped his authority. What does this mean for businesses that rely on imports and for U.S. trading partners? We're going to put those questions to NPR's Scott Horsley. Hey, Scott.
Great to be with you.
Let's start with these court rulings. What did they say?
They say that the president does not have the power to issue the kind of sweeping worldwide tariffs we've seen this spring, at least not under the 1977 emergency law the White House has been relying on. If those rulings hold up, many of the import taxes Trump has ordered since coming back to the White House would go away. Now, that is a big if. The administration is appealing these decisions, but it is a ray of hope for importers like Sarah Wells. She sells tote bags and other products for nursing moms. And she's already gotten a surprise tariff bill this year for an extra $15,000. She could be due for a refund.
I feel a lot of relief and hope. We still have some work going on in the court system in terms of the appeal. So I'm very cautiously optimistic at this point.
For Wells and many other business people, this week's court rulings were just the latest twist in what has been a dizzying few months on the tariff front.
I mean, it's so hard to keep track of. Even before the courts got involved, the president himself seemed to be changing his mind on tariffs.
Yeah, I mean, the tariffs have gone up and down like a yo-yo, and there are threats they will go up again. So just imagine trying to run a business in this environment. Wells had just placed an order with a factory in Cambodia when Trump's April 2nd tariffs were announced, and suddenly she was looking at a potential 49% increase in the cost of her merchandise.
I put that order on hold. Then the Trump administration came out with the 90-day pause, bringing it down to 10%, which was low enough for me to put my order back in play, but none of that has shipped yet because there is such a slowdown in restarting manufacturing and supply chain. I have not received anything yet.
If the tariffs go away altogether, Wells could go back to manufacturing in China as she used to. In the meantime, though, she's running really low on inventory and says she's likely to sell out of some of her most popular products within the next couple of months.
And as all this has been going on, the president and his team have been negotiating with U.S. trading partners. How is that going?
Yeah, one of the ways the White House has tried to justify these tariffs is by saying they are a tool to bring other countries to the bargaining table. So far, those bargaining sessions have not produced a lot of results. The only trade agreement so far is a framework deal with the UK, a country the U.S. already had a trade surplus with. Talks with China are apparently not going very well. Trump complained on social media yesterday that China wasn't acting in good faith. Earlier, he had complained about a lack of progress in talks with the European Union. In both those cases, Trump has threatened to impose higher tariffs if no deal is reached, although that threat may not be as big of a bargaining chip now that the president's authority to levy those tariffs is in doubt.
Scott, the White House is arguing that tariffs are a big moneymaker for the government. Is that true?
So far this year, tariffs have brought in about $68 billion for the government. That's a substantial increase. It's about 80% more than this time last year. Keep in mind, most of that money is coming out of the pockets of businesses and shoppers in this country, not foreign countries, as the president likes to argue. Now, a lot of that tariff revenue has been raised in just the last couple of months. The question is, will those taxes continue to flow to the government, or will these tariffs be negotiated away by the president, or perhaps struck down by the courts? You know, it's hard for Congress to know as policymakers try to craft a budget, and it's hard for businesses, too. Adam Hirsch of the Economic Policy Institute says that can be really paralyzing.
Businesses don't know what the tariff policy is going to be tomorrow, let alone 2-3 years from now, the way they have to be planning. It's not giving businesses the confidence to make those investments, so they're just sit on their hands and wait for this to pass.
That uncertainty is likely to continue for a while. One thing we've learned from this tumultuous tariff experiment is that when import taxes are really high, they actually don't raise much money for the government because people just stop importing stuff.
NPR Scott Horsley, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It is time now for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, and for reasons that will become clear in just a moment, I am going to hand over the hosting duties here and bring in all things considered host Ari Shapiro.
Ta-da! How the tables have turned.
I guess this means you're asking me questions.
I am! You just got back from Rome, and I love this because you and I often hang out in each other's offices. Hosts talk to each other about what goes on behind the scenes. Now we get to actually share that with other people out in the world. So take us to that moment. You're there covering the new Pope's selection, the conclave. What was it like in the moment that you saw the white smoke coming out of the chimney? Where were you?
This was interesting. I had thought so much about what this would be like to wait and just stare at this chimney in the Sistine Chapel, which is one of the most famous, beautiful places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first 3 or 4 hours or so of staring at the chimney, it was really exciting. And I was on the edge of my seat and just waiting. And then it was kind of waiting. You know?
There was a seagull.
There was seagull, a lot of seagulls, a lot of waiting, and we kind of figured out the rhythms of when smoke would appear, black smoke, and when it was safe to wander away. And there was a point on that Thursday where I thought, okay, if this ballot had happened, it would have happened by now, and we would have seen the black smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be back in a few minutes.
Oh, so you left.
So I left. I left our broadcast area, which, it's important for later, was a fenced-in area. There was like a maybe 4-foot-high fence surrounding the area.
Uh-huh.
And I walked about, if St. Peter's Square is a clock, our broadcast booth was at 6 o'clock, the Basilica is at 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So I walked over to about 3 o'clock, where my favorite thing in all of the square was, it was this marble water fountain of papal tiaras. It was 3 papal tiaras with a little spout coming out of it. And I just loved the papal tiara water fountain. I'm like, I'm going to go refill my water bottle in the papal tiara water fountain.
So it was an actual drinking fountain.
Yes.
Was it holy water?
I'd like to think so. So I went there with Tyler Bartlett, my producer, and I walk over to get water, and we're just chit-chatting, and we just hear this scream, and a scream turns into a roar that spreads out throughout the entire square.
Because there were thousands of people there.
Yeah, just waiting for this moment, and we see white smoke, and we both look at each other, and we yell, Pope! And we ran as fast as we could, because the goal was to get on the air as soon as there was white smoke.
Live special rolling coverage. Yeah.
So I ran as fast as I could.
I'm imagining you shoving spectators aside, body slamming people.
I didn't have to throw an elbow, but I was ready. We're getting back as quickly as possible, and we come up, and there's a security checkpoint for the broadcasting area where you have to go, you have to show a code, they have to scan you, it takes a moment. And our editor, Courtney Dorning, just says, jump, just jump. And I truly don't actually have memory of this, but I apparently, without stopping, did a running jump, vaulted over, pushed my hand down, jumped over the fence, sat down, said, okay, put on my headphones, and we were on the air like 30 seconds later. You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow, coming to you from the edge of St. Peter's Square. The bells are tolling at St. Peter's. White smoke has billowed out of the Sistine Chapel's chimney, and that means the Catholic Church has a new pope. This election comes on the second day of the papal conclave.
So first you have to fill time until you find out who the pope was.
Yes.
And then you find out who it is. Already, this is going to be huge news, whoever the new pope is. And then you find out that he's an American from Chicago. I heard that moment in your voice on the air.
Oh, my goodness. The pope is from Chicago. Robert Francis Prevost has been selected as the next pope of the Roman Catholic Church,
a 69 to have the name be announced as American, this suddenly becomes this monumental historical moment for Americans. Never in the history of the church has the Pope been American. And as a Catholic growing up, I was taught it's just never going to happen.
Right.
Because they wouldn't elect an American because America has so much power in the world already. But yeah, it was an exciting moment. And listening back, you could hear that I was excited because we're in this amazing space at this cool breaking news moment. And I don't know, I was excited to be there.
I think there's something about live coverage that allows you to get caught up in the moment in a way that is journalistically appropriate, mm-hmm. whether you're talking about an inauguration or a new pope or the emotion of a tragedy if you're covering a war or a natural disaster.
Yeah.
Being an unbiased, nonpartisan, use whatever words you want to use, journalist doesn't mean you can't feel the electricity in the room. And
right.
You could really hear that in your voice.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think that's something that you and I both feel that way. And I don't know necessarily if people in our positions 20 or 30 years ago felt that way. That I think like it's okay to sound human, right? And I think about the fact that last summer I was in the host chair when the Trump assassination attempt took place. And
right.
The first conversation we had on the line was our colleague, Danielle Kurtzleben, who had been in the middle.
At the rally,
ducking under a table, terrified. And the first thing I'm doing is talking to Danielle, and I just like, are you okay?
Wondering about like what might happen next.
You're in a safe position right now just to ask that?
Yes. People are streaming by. Most of in the crowd have already left. The leaving started pretty immediately.
Then we were doing interviews with people who had been in the crowd with their children. I think just like letting your humanity show through and being empathetic is important.
Do you remember the first time you ever did live special coverage?
Yes, and it was totally terrifying.
I often find it totally terrifying.
I've always been attracted to it. Of all the things of broadcast news, special coverage has been the most exciting to me. I actually remember listening to you do it for Arab Spring at one point. You were like filling in on Talk of the Nation, and I had a long car drive.
Talk of the Nation, that's a throwback.
And
yeah,
you were doing it for hours. And it's just, you know, it was always cool as a listener for me to think about those moments. And the first time I got a chance to, I was actually pretty new at NPR. We were going to simulcast a PBS presidential debate. And all I had to do was talk for a minute because it was, you know, it started at like 10:01, right? And the mic opened at 10 o'clock. And I still remember the feeling of just like my throat going down to my toes and back up. From NPR News, this is special coverage of the PBS NewsHour Democratic primary debate. I'm Scott Detrow. In a moment, we expect former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator...
And I don't think I sound as bad as I think I sounded, but just like, you're listening to live special coverage!
Just because, like, usually there's no script at all, you know? And over time, I've gotten more comfortable with that, and I kind of enjoy the adrenaline rush of that.
You said it's your favorite thing. Why?
You know, I've always wanted to be a reporter. I think I've always wanted to be a broadcast journalist. I actually come from a family of broadcast journalists. My dad was a longtime radio news anchor. My uncle was a longtime DJ in San Diego. So like just like talking into microphones is a big part of my family. And I think like growing up, as I first started to get interested in it, like those big moments where the TV anchors are bringing you through an election or a big breaking story was always exciting to me. As I got older, I would element to being a nerd and like pulling up YouTube clips of kind of like live special coverage through the years of big breaking stories and just kind of like watching it to see, especially as I started doing it, to see like how the anchors or hosts handle one moment or the other. Like the idea that you don't have a safety net and you don't have a script in front of you and it's kind of up to you to think on your feet and kind of bring the audience along with you. I like putting myself in the audience's shoes and asking, sometimes just stopping a reporter and asking a really, really basic question because I'm thinking of like, what is the person totally fresh to the story need to know? And I think just like not being afraid to ask a really basic question. I think sometimes we want to like try and impress the people who are listening or who we're interviewing. And I think like usually with special coverage, the most basic question is what's happening? Why is that happening? Who is this person?
What are you seeing?
Yeah, what are you seeing? Tell us what's in front of your eyes, especially for something like that. Like, what are you seeing? And then we go to Ruth Sherlock in the crowd. Like, people are overjoyed and waving American flags and crying in the middle of St. Peter's Square, and it's an exciting moment, you know? Like, that's the story right there.
My favorite moment from listening to your live special coverage in Rome was when you thanked your Latin teacher at the end.
I want to thank my high school Latin teacher, Father Robert Cregan, for this moment where we were translating Latin on the radio. Thank you so much for listening. Again, a lot more coverage of this enormous story. I'm Scott Detrow. We will talk to you soon. Father Cregan, he was my teacher freshman year Latin. He is no longer with us, but it just jumped into my head. I was like, you know, never before and probably never again is translating Latin something I'm going to be using as part of my job. So I'm just going to take this moment to thank him.
It was a great moment. Scott, thank you for letting us flip the tables and answering my questions for a change.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Has your grocery bill gone up? Do you hesitate to buy a new piece of clothing or maybe even a service you need? What if you could get your needs met without using cash? LifeKit has a few tips about bartering, that is, exchanging things that both parties want. Kyle Norris reports.
The first step, if you want to try bartering, is to do a little inventory and think about what you could offer that other people might want. Cindy Benitez runs a giant barter fair in Washington State. It's called the Okanagan Family Barter Fair. Benitez says, think about your creative skills or hobbies as potential things you could barter. For example, she makes homemade soap. During the fall, Benitez trades her soap with a family of hunters.
You know, around October, when they're done hunting, they'll get a hold of me and they'll say, we have deer fat and we have some meat for you. And I'll trade them for the deer fat and render it and then make soap. And then I trade them back part of the soap.
When she's at the fair, Benitez trades her soap for things like tea, honey, earrings, and scarves. And that's another thing to keep in mind. Consider the things you'd like to receive in a barter too. Benitez says one popular thing to barter is food, whether that's surplus vegetables from your garden or a homemade meal or baked goods. Your professional skills could also be something you can offer. Like if you're an accountant, you can help someone with their budget and they could help you with some yard work. Oh, and keep in mind, if you do barter more than $600 in a year of your business service, you need to declare that on your taxes. That's according to the Internal Revenue Service. And of course, you'll need to find other people down to trade. The good news is you usually don't have to look too far. Think neighbors, friends, coworkers, and groups you're already a part of. Alana Hurley was born and raised in Southwest Alaska. She grew up with her grandma, who bartered smoked salmon with maintenance workers who worked on her grandmother's property. Hurley is Yupik and works for a tribal consortium. She travels for work and meets other Alaska natives, and they often barter for traditional foods, including caribou, clams, and crabs. Hurley has a suggestion of how to dip your toe in the bartering waters. When you're about to make a transaction, try saying this: we could pay for this in cash.
Or I have maybe a more exciting or intriguing idea. What about trading or bartering for something? And I feel like that perks people's ears, like, ooh, intriguing. What could we trade?
People might say no, but the goal is to open the door to the possibility of bartering. And finally, some loose guidelines can help things feel fair. Is this a one-time trade or something more long-term? Hurley says don't be afraid to ask the other person what they think would be fair.
I think at the end of the day, whatever the trade looks like, the bartering looks like, you want it to be respectful and reciprocal of time and effort and energy.
You can even write up a simple contract. Bartering can help you meet your needs as an individual, but it can also be a reminder that we all have value. That's according to Jessica Gordon Nemhard. She's an economist and professor at John Jay College, City University of New York.
Bartering really allows us to get back to those roots as human beings who care about each other, who believe in reciprocity, solidarity, balance.
She also says her favorite thing about bartering is that it shows we all have gifts we can share, including our skills and our creativity. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Norris.
For more tips from LifeKit, go to npr.org/LifeKit. This is NPR News.
Danny and Michael Filippo create horror movies that critics love and make audiences scream. And that's the way they like it.
I love that it's scaring people as well as touching them. That feels so incredible.
Their new movie, Bring Her Back, and all the latest news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The United Nations says Israel banned aid to Gaza from Jordan and Egypt, leaving hundreds of millions of dollars worth of food and medicine stuck in warehouses and on trucks. The Supreme Court handed President Trump a temporary win yesterday, permitting the administration to prematurely end a humanitarian program that had granted two-year legal status to more than a half million people from Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. And Moderna says the FDA approved its next-generation COVID vaccine for those 65 and older and those 12 to 64 who have at least one underlying risk factor. It can be stored in refrigerators rather than freezers, giving it a longer shelf life and easier distribution. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Mexicans are headed to the polls on Sunday for an election that will change the face of the country's judiciary. For the first time in Mexico's history, voters will pick among nearly 8,000 candidates to replace all of the federal and state judges in the country, making Mexico one of a few countries in the world to elect their judges instead of appointing them. NPR's Eder Peralta joins us from Mexico City. Hey, Eder.
Hey, Scott.
So this is going to make Mexico an outlier. Why is the country changing its judicial system now, and why in such a broad way?
Well, I mean, this is the result of an epic fight between branches of government. I mean, basically, you have to go back to the previous president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And he always complained that the courts in Mexico were political, that they were corrupt, that they were rotten with nepotism. And then as he's taking these shots at the courts, the Supreme Court, Mexico's Supreme Court, strikes down one of his key proposals. The court says that he couldn't put the National Guard, which is a civilian force, under military command. And López Obrador is furious. He tells the Mexican public that the judiciary has to be made more democratic. So he and his party, Morena, propose a constitutional amendment that changes the way judges in Mexico become judges. And, you know, this is a super popular president with a super majority in Congress, and the amendment passes easily. Not only that, but a new president takes power, Claudia Sheinbaum, but she comes from his same party, and she supports this reform.
I mean, that is a really interesting storyline, especially at this point where there's tensions playing out in a similar way in the U.S. and elsewhere. But one of the things that I noted up top was there are thousands of candidates. How exactly is this election going to work?
I mean, it's going to look a lot like a regular election. Voters are going to go to their polling place, except they're faced with a tough task. Just one example, the Supreme Court. Nine justices will come out from this election, but there are 64 candidates. And keeping it very real here, very few people here have any idea who any of these candidates are. And it's not like they're getting any ads on TV or many interviews with these candidates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they could make an informed decision. The way it's working is the Electoral Commission has posted the candidates' resumes on its website, and that's how voters are supposed to make a decision. So, you know, voters have a ton of homework to do before they head to the polls. And it also leaves a lot of people wondering just what kind of judiciary Mexico will be left with.
One of the more eye-popping aspects of this is that there are candidates affiliated with organized crime. Do we know how many there are or how they even got on the ballot?
I mean, civil society groups have identified dozens of candidates that they say are likely to have ties with drug cartels. And then there are some that have clear ties to the cartels. El Chapo was one of Mexico's biggest drug lords, and now his former lawyer is on the ballot in the state of Sinaloa. There are a few other candidates who served time for drug trafficking, and they're running to be federal judges. And there was a commission in the legislature that was supposed to vet candidates, but they had weeks to get through thousands of candidates. I've spoken to some of the candidates who say that the process was just riddled with irregularities. Some didn't get an interview at all, or they got rejected by the online system. Some told me that their interview lasted minutes. So this was very much a harried process.
The way you describe this, I'm wondering, is there anyone defending this or anybody who thinks that this is a good idea for the country's democracy?
I mean, it's hard to find a scholar here in Mexico or anywhere else for that matter who thinks it's a good idea. Judiciaries are designed to be kept at arm's length from the political system, and this change throws the judiciary smack in the middle of the political arena. One of the current Supreme Court justices, who says he's not going to vote in this election, has said that this is, quote, a historic mistake, that it weakens the judiciary, that it cuts into its independence. Monica Castillejos Aragon used to be a clerk at the Mexican Supreme Court, and now she teaches comparative law at UC Berkeley, and she says it's clear what's happening here.
Mexico is just returning to the old days of the authoritarian regime, but Morena was able to develop a more sophisticated system.
And what she means is that the old PRI, which ruled Mexico for 70 years, tended to undermine the judiciary. Castillejos Aragon says this feels like a full takeover by the now ruling party Morena, and it's modeled after other authoritarian takeovers, including what Viktor Orban did in Hungary. And let's not forget, this is a constitutional reform, so it's going to be very difficult to roll back, and Mexicans will have to live with the consequences of this for years to come.
That is NPR's Eder Peralta reporting from Mexico City. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
When poet Emily Wright had her first child, she wanted to capture the experience and the changes that come with motherhood. So when her baby slept, Wright would steal away and write down whatever inspired her. The result is a new book of poetry called Fierce Delight. It paints a vivid picture of the early stages of motherhood, while also including aspects of Bright's life that extend beyond the label of mother.
My name is Emily Wright. I am a writer and a radio producer living in St. Paul, Minnesota. I have been writing poetry my whole life. I think poetry is particularly useful during times that feel very rich or very intense. I've always had this drive to put it into words in some way. And so I was writing poems throughout my first pregnancy and throughout the first, I'd say, 3 years of my daughter's life. And a few of the poems were written with this knowledge that everything is going to change. There will be a complete recentering of my life in a way I won't be able to understand till I'm there, but we're on the cusp of it, and we're balanced on that cusp of it for quite a long period of time, 9 months, where you get to imagine, but you're not in it yet. And so I think that period of waiting and imagining can be a very rich creative time. I'd like to read the first poem in the collection. It's called Pears and Soon a Threesome. Summer, and the trees are luscious. We stroll, eyes closed to better smell the cedar. For once, I am not forming words. A bear cub lopes onto the road like a dog, but hardier, carefree, then ducks back toward mama in the trees. You trace my belly with your palms while baby spins inside me. You can't tell yet, but she loves your touch. Canoeing on the lake reveals half a dozen eagles. They mate for life, you say. One surveys, its partner tucks against the pine. In the ultrasound, we saw her face, ghost imprint of our dreams. My heartbeat is her anchor. She was playing with her feet. We wear bright colors while the sun lasts, take our dinners in the breeze. Wonder sweet as this, you have to cup it in both hands. The collection is broken into two sections. The first section is, "And Suddenly I Was a Mother." And the second is, "And Still I Was Myself." Often when we have children, especially for mothers, somehow we get reduced down to the person who changes diapers and wipes up spills. And so it was also important to me to include poems about the other aspects of being a person, of also being a wife and a daughter and an intelligent person with interests and career aspirations. And there's also a great deal of the joy and the comfort of nature, because that's something that just continuously brings me joy. Here's a poem called Midnight Kayaking. How many lights in blackness? Jupiter has set, the Milky Way winds clear as any road. Bioluminescence streams out from my bow, eddies with each paddle dip. I scan for your brief lighted trail, find you almost close enough to touch. We are skimming on the surface of a thousand interactions. A lobster trapped, a cormorant spreads its feathers wide and drying in the dark. A supernova ruptures millions of years off, and yes, I have always been afraid of sharks and sudden accidents. I would not have come tonight, except you shouldered your kayak down the beach and paused at the silent edge of water. Down the bay, the seals roiled, grumbling like stomachs. I keep having to remember how much is alive, how we are alive inside it. I paddle to you and we sit, night-blinded, kayaks linked, while the ocean carries us like driftwood down the bay. When I realized that I was putting together a collection, I was thoughtful of which notes need to be in here, because nobody wants to hear about just the wonderful things, because that's not true. So I also wanted to allow in the parts that are messy, the parts where we are tired, where we are frustrated. Nothing good happens at 3 a.m. You know, I write about miscarriage because it is so common and so not talked about. And so if poems in this collection make people feel seen, what a gift. I really hope that people read this collection and feel seen.
That was poet Emily Bright. Her collection, Fierce Delight, is out now. For a quarter of a century now, a group of contestants has dropped into a remote location to voluntarily battle for food and supplies, compete in physical and mental challenges, and duke it out for $1 million in the title of Sole Survivor. Today marks the 25th anniversary of Survivor. The show is now coming up on its 50th season. And while it's changed over time, it has long had a passionate fan base. Some are passionate enough to turn reality TV into reality, like our very own All Things Considered producer, Mia Venkat. She is part of a group that meets up every year to play their own real-life version of Survivor. Last weekend, they did it for the fourth time, this time in Collegeville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. You ready to be back in the trenches?
No.
Kara Shoaibi and Anna Wickham are my best friends from college. They've been planning the Survivor weekend for a year. Wickham says she's likely spent about 200 active hours working on it, between challenge ideas and logistics.
But if I'm talking hours lying awake at night, thinking of a twist or a new advantage or something that our friends had never seen before, I mean, I don't want to say four figures, but it's a lot.
Welcome! Wonderful day of Survivor. How are we feeling?
Shoaibi and Wickham are the game runners this year. Or as we call it, they're our Jeff Probst, the show's longtime host.
Grab a torch, dip it in, and get fire.
They've planned a true gauntlet of challenges for us this weekend. The point is to win, so you're immune from getting voted out of the game. Some challenges are reminiscent of fan favorites.
Brought to us first in season 10, this game is called Hot Pursuit.
Others they cooked up in their diabolical minds. First thing in the morning, they make us jump into the cold pool to do a swim test. Later, some players had to tread water with both hands holding spoons, balancing lacrosse balls above the water.
Remember, this is also endurance.
Juliana McCormick, who flew in from California for this, lasts 41 minutes.
At Survivor Collegeville, the players, or castaways, are pushed to their physical and emotional limits. We range from Survivor superfans to folks who haven't even seen a full season. There are people that have been friends for more than 10 years, and others that are meeting each other for the first time. But everyone's committed to having the authentic Survivor experience. Nick Richardson has been a part of this Survivor tradition since our first game in 2022.
But it's incredibly nauseating and anxiety-inducing. I could throw up right here on your shoes.
So why do we do it? Why does anyone?
The allure of Survivor is a siren song.
I called up Rob Sesternino. He's been a fan of the show since it first aired in 2000. And he's played two seasons of The Real Survivor. He also hosts Rob Has a Podcast. It's basically the unofficial Survivor podcast. He says what makes the game so appealing is the human element.
How the players have to manage their relationships that they've built with their own selfish desires to both be the winner and to get the money. I think it's something that maybe we've wrestled with in our own personal lives. What are we willing to do to have success?
Sesternino told me the fan base for the show runs deep. There are fans all over that try to recreate their own versions of the game.
But yours is the most intense I've ever heard.
I fear he might be right. The Real Survivor has backstabbing, lying, building and breaking alliances. Our games are no different.
Yeah, the second I saw someone walk away with someone else on my top, I was like, oh, they want me out.
I was very proud. I made it to the beginning of day two. I knew I had a target on my back, but I was safe. I found a hidden immunity idol.
Okay, I found something. This is the best day of my life.
The one thing that can protect you in this game.
If anyone has an idol or an advantage and they would like to play it, now would be the time to do so.
Call an ambulance, but not for me.
I presented my immunity idol.
I would like to use this on myself.
This is not an immunity idol.
Yeah! So it turns out that idol was in fact fake. Planted by someone I thought was my ally.
11th person voted out of Survivor Collegeville.
Me up.
Dear listener, my game was over. I sat with the rest of the folks voted out at this point, otherwise known as the jury. We can't participate in any more challenges, but when the game is down to the final three, we each get to vote for who we think deserves to win. After what is somehow only 2 days, we reach the moment we've all been waiting for. It's time to crown a winner. The three finalists make their cases, then the jury has the floor. Jury member Patrick Rice takes this opportunity to brutally call out one of the finalists.
Do you feel like what he said aligns with the game motto, outwit, outplay, outlast? I heard everything you said, and I heard manipulate, use, discard.
I want to remind you all at this time, we are not playing for any money. In fact, we paid to be here. A split and scorned jury cast their votes.
Jay, my vote is for you.
I never thought that I would write this name in a final tribal council.
Nick was the one mostly playing a really social game.
Justin, you really made a strong case tonight.
The winner.
Justin Grant, the underdog from Seattle, takes home the title.
I think I played the most well-rounded game. I think I played the only game that actually had integrity.
It'll take all of us some time to get over the brutal blindsides and broken alliances of Survivor Collegeville. But I know, without fail, in a year's time, we'll be coming for each other once again at our Survivor Season 5. Mia Venkat, NPR News.
The tribe has spoken. That's all things considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, VentureX. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.